We're going to go ahead and get started. It's about 11:30, and so we have a highly engaging, participatory session scheduled for you. And so we want to make full advantage of the time that we have. And I want to welcome you to this session. My name is Al Richmond. I am the Executive Director of Community Campus Partnerships for Health, and we are so excited to really join with the Community-Based Public Health Caucus in sponsoring today's session. And again, I think you will find it highly engaging and very participatory in nature. My colleagues have really worked, I think, tirelessly to make sure that that's the case today. So it's very bi-directional, and it's very engaging. So I want to make sure, I'll just repeat, if you don't see it on the screen, so to make sure that you're in the right session, because I've gone to APHA and sat through about 10, 15 minutes of a session only to realize I was in the wrong room. And then I thought, you know what, it's too far over to the next hotel. I might as well stay. I'm sure I can learn something new. So the title of this session is Holding Researchers and Research Accountable to Communities, the Role of Community IRBs and Research Review Committees. My task is to introduce our speakers, and they will take it from there. And so I just want to kind of give you an overview of today's session, and that our primary goals for today are to demonstrate the range of mechanisms and strategies that communities have for ensuring that research that is being done in their communities is both ethical and impactful. The work also will share with you the ways in which they have documented the impact of community review processes and research and community capacity. I'm very excited about this work. I think that it is highly, it's very powerful work. I think that as you hear from each of our speakers today, you will agree with that. And certainly they'll talk to you about resources that are available to really kind of find out more about this work, in particular a report that the Community Campus Partnerships for Health has published, kind of to describe this work. I want to introduce my partners, friends, and colleagues today who are part of this presentation. And they include Dr. Nancy Shore, who's with the University of New England and also with Community Campus Partnerships for Health. Mayling Isaacs, who is a force of nature, and you will find that out very soon as you feel the winds of Hawaii blowing in and the cool breezes. And so she's with the Papaolaka Lokahi Center in Hawaii, and she'll say more about that. Also, John Cooks, who is another force of nature, who is a true Southern gentleman in the truest sense of the word there, from the Galveston Island Community Research Advisory Committee. And also, we hope that Elmer Freeman will join us a little bit later. Elmer has been kind of overbooked, and if you know Elmer, that's his life. And so we hope that he will join us shortly as well. He's with CHEERS in Boston, which is the Center for Community Health, Education, Research, and Services. And last but not least is another force of nature, but Alice Park, who's of Community Campus Partnerships for Health, who will talk to you this morning, but also is tasked with keeping us all on time. And so we'll be on time when I sit down. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy today.
Thank you, Al. I'm going to start off, can people hear me okay? I'm going to start off giving a little bit about the study background, but I first have to say, everyone was a force of nature except me. I'm so sorry. Hopefully by the end of the session, I can like...
You're Mother Nature.
You're Mother Nature.
Okay, I think that maybe I'll take that. We wanted to start off this session today just to give a little bit of background about what we did, In essence, we just completed a two-year study funded by NIH that involved involved a cross-case analysis of five community research review processes. And this study actually built off something that we did at CCPH in 2009. It was an online survey that was done to identify different community groups and partnerships that have a research review process in place, and we found over 100 community groups and partnerships had one. And from that survey, we found that we had some good insight into how these review processes worked, but really wanted to take a step back and get a more in-depth understanding of how communities decide whether and how research will happen in their community, and also to get a better understanding of what impacts these review processes make on research. And so we felt the timing was right because there seemed to be a growing recognition that community-engaged research is a critical approach to understanding and addressing health disparities. And to this end, Community Campus Partnerships and five partners came together and submitted a grant with these as our specific aims. One was to articulate the research ethics and integrity considerations, experiences, and outcomes of community-based processes for research ethics review. Two was to assess similarities and difference in the research ethics and integrity issues raised by community-based processes for research ethics review and those raised by institution-based IRBs. And three, to identify and disseminate promising practices for assuring the ethics and integrity of community-engaged research to community groups, researchers, institutional IRBs, funding agencies, and policymakers. So, our five partners were co-investigators on the study, and they were also the community-based research review administrators from the following organizations. And I know Al mentioned Elmer Freeman from CHEERS, John from Galveston Island Community Research Advisory Committee, Lola Sablon Santos, who's not here today, but she is from Guam Communications Network in Long Beach, Mei Ling, and Eric Watt, who's also not able to be here today, from Special Service for Groups in Los Angeles. And if you notice, the third column on this table describes the kind of review process each of these organizations operate. So, for example, Galveston Island and Guam Communications Network have research review committees. Papa'ola'olokahi and Special Service for Groups have community IRBs, federally recognized community IRBs, and CHEERS has an emerging review committee. So again, real brief overview of our methods. In year one, we did case studies of each partner's review process. We shorthand call those CRPs. Did interviews with CRP chairs and administrators, researchers who submitted proposals to the review process, focus groups with the community review process members, document analysis, and observations of two CRP meetings in action. And year two, the team came together and had an in-person meeting in Seattle, and we did a focus group with all the team members and, you know, talked about such questions as how do the review processes compare to each other, what are the key issues that the review processes consider, what are some of the benefits and some of the challenges, and we'll get into some of that later in the presentation. What I would also add is that throughout the 2 years together as a study team, we met monthly by phone, and we accomplished a lot during these monthly calls, including finalizing the grant, finalizing the methods that we wanted to use, discussing emerging findings, talking about what we wanted to do in terms of next steps, which we'll also talk about later on in the presentation. So those calls were really important to helping the study stay true to what the aims were and to making sure that we were on target. I would be really happy to answer any questions people have about the methods or the study. We have a designated time for Q&A, but in the interest of time, I wanted to turn this over to the force of nature, Mei Ling, to talk about Papa'ola'olokahi.
Thank you.
Aloha kakai aka. First of all, I want to say good morning and thank you. Also, to recognize our folks from last night, our hosts from last night. Come on, you guys, stand up. Let's see you. You're all in that row. Come on, come on. These people are extraordinary community people from here who are recognized for their work in the community ever since, well, before Hurricane Katrina, but Hurricane Katrina push them forward. I'm so proud of the work that you guys have done for the community and for the rest of the world for preserving this wonderful, wonderful city. Thank you so much. Okay, here we go. This is us guys, Papa Ola Lokahi. We are an institutional review board. We follow federal regulations, but we're more than that. We are building parity in our community. You know how the universities and clinics, they all kind of own research, or they think they own research, and they come down and they tell us what we should be doing, how we should be doing it, but we need you, that sort of thing. Well, when about 14 years ago, we said, no, we're not going to play that game anymore. We want a piece of the action. We want to determine for ourselves what's going on, because we know more than anybody else what the pain and the suffering is in our community. And we know better than anybody else how to solve those problems. So move aside. We're going to use your federal guidelines because we want to be federally recognized. We want to be able to say yay or nay to a protocol or research project that comes in our community. So we started. We didn't know what we were doing, but we did it anyway, right? So when we came in, people were catching different waves. University was looking at their need to raise money, to publish, and to stay in the game. These are not bad people. These are good people. They want to advance science and knowledge. We were interested in our community and our community suffering and the need for help and all this stuff called health disparities. We want to level the playing field. So we began. And as you can see, research is a highly, highly competitive field. There's a lot of money there. There's rights to publication. There's recognition. There's the holy grail of the Nobel Prize. That's what. And there's millions of dollars, you know. UH alone gets about $300 million a year on this stuff. But you see these little guys in the bottom, you see those little turtles, you know how the egg hatches and all these guys are running for the ocean, trying to make it there. Well, this is kind of the same thing. We're trying to make it there, but we're being run over by these big guys, you know. And it's not that they're bad, they're just bigger and stronger and whatever, they got the bucks. Okay, so this is their rent. And this is what you're up against. Multi-million dollar industry. They're highly organized. They're institutionalized. They've got a bureaucracy. They've got institutions. They've got drug companies. They've got experts. They've got scientists. Long-standing relationship, highly competitive, and they choose what is being studied. That's big difference, right? And here are us guys. Okay? We're not formally organized. We have very few resources. You know, we're burdened. We carry the burden of disease. And we live in a predatory environment, right? It's predatory. But look at what we got. We have a lot of resiliency. We are closely connected to our culture, just as you guys are, closely connected to your people. And we have this connection to our birthplace. We know who we are because this is our aina. This is our land. This is who we are. We're non-competitive, however, we have strength in numbers. That's what we got. And we know, this little saying at the bottom, it's Hawaiian, you know, Kamehia Ohu O Kahono, the mystical knowledge of the path. Nobody sent those little turtles to kindergarten or high school to learn how to do things and where to go and how to come back. They knew it. They knew it in here. It's in here. And that's what you guys got. You got that innate knowledge, yeah, so that's a lot. So you got all this stuff, but there's certain responsibilities, you know. A research industry has a responsibility to build cultural sensitivity into their protocol, right? To invest in your communities. That's their responsibility. And invest in building your infrastructure. They can't, you know, they can't do what we, Lola, calls helicopter research. You fly in, you fly out. You got you want, and you know what you need, and you fly out. You take your PhD, your postgraduate degree, whatever you, what it is you want, you know. You can't do that anymore. We say, no, you have a responsibility to us. But we have a responsibility as a community as well. we got to be ready to invest your time and your energy. You got to be ready to invest your experience and resources. And you say, oh, we haven't got the $1 million. You don't need the $1 million. What you need is your relationships, your ability to call one another, to act and to perform in behalf of your people. That's what you got. And you got to be willing to mentor. And not only mentor your own people, but mentor those poor little researchers who are coming in who don't know a thing. You know, they come in, they don't know anything. Part of your job is to help mentor them. Because what we're all looking forward to is advancing and building new knowledge so that we, as a people, can live a healthier life. It's not what we're all about. We're about making life better. Making life better for ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, our community, you know, New Orleans, the world. It's about making it better. And science is about that, too. It's about making things better. Sometimes we forget when we're in an institutional setting, university setting. It's about making things better. And the people I work with now come drink Ava together. It's coming together. Some people have the peace pie. Some people have this or that. We drink Ava and we eat. Yeah. So coming together. Let's huddle. Let's be a family together. It's people who live here. It's people who are teaching our kids at the university. It's all of us guys coming together, drinking the bowl of Ava or the peace and be one. And let's move this thing forward because there's such value and there's such richness in both. You know, universities have vast resources and vast libraries and vast knowledge. And they're in charge of teaching our children when we send there. But we are responsible for raising our children. We're responsible for the health of our communities, yeah? So that's what you guys are about. And last night I was just so awestruck. You know, at the end, this wonderful woman started singing that song that would keep your little light burning. You know, somebody's in the valley that needs to find their way home. That's what it's all about. You keep that little light burning. That's who you are. You're that light, that flame. So that's all I got to say. Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I am especially glad to be here, of course, to see some familiar faces. And I'm extremely glad to be in New Orleans because it took me to come to New Orleans to become a force of nature. So I'm going to go back and let them know I've been elevated. But I bring you greetings from the Galveston Island Community Research Advisory Committee. Short for that is GICRAC, G-I-C-R-A-C, because that's a mouthful and I really have trouble all the time getting that out. But we're on the island of Galveston. You can go ahead and switch. And this is a photo of some of the people and who we are and some of the things that we do there on the island. It's a group of, you can go ahead and switch, please, thank you. Our mission statement, we are the gatekeepers for the health and well-being among African Americans in Galveston County. We're committed to advocating, participating, and endorsing health research and related services by participating in the selection, design, implementation, and results sharing of research. And while that is a wonderful statement, basically we jump in there, we want to be in from the beginning all the way to the end, from the root to the tooth. Okay, and we're not playing with it. Our part of what we do and what I kind of coined in the study is we'll sometimes do backdoor CPR, CBPR, because ideally we want to be on the front end, but we know that in the world in which we work, it doesn't always happen. But what we have determined that even though it may have already been formed, we still have a place and can try to be a reckoning force as best we can for what it is that we know and still affect some of the things that go on. And we'll talk to you about that a little bit later. Okay, thank you, ma'am. And I couldn't make Nancy push because as a teacher, me just likes to talk. But ideally, in terms of the impact that we are working on trying to make and some that we would like to think that we made is to community capacity building, making sure the university knows that we are there, and then making sure that we have a line in the budget, which is extremely important. Because, of course, Galveston is an island, 2 miles wide. So how do you not know that you're there, especially if you're going to do this? And it's in under the premise that we are both here and we need to work together. A part of our mission, we were funded through NIH and the Partners in Research grant. Some of you may be familiar with that. They did 37, if I'm not mistaken, 37 joint grants between the academic institution and communities, and each one got their separate budget from NIH, and part of that was bridging the gap between the university and the community. So that's what we're steadily working, even though that grant is over, but we're still working under that premise to keep things going with what it is that we do. Thank you. Good. Some of the challenges, partnering with an academic institution. Community and academia, other than academia doing something to to the community, it doesn't have, we live in two different worlds, but we're still the part, we occupy the same space. And so there's that bi-directional that definitely has to happen, because we, as community, we don't walk into the institution just knowing how it is that you function. And certainly the institution doesn't walk into the community, even though they do walk into the community, knowing totally how that community functions. But even though they come in all the time, they're not as successful as they would like to be because of the fact that they've not done what it is that they need to do to ensure that you're successful and build the relationships that you need. And that's a part of what we do. Helping them understand how we work. We don't work on a 30-day invoice. Because that's how you get out of it. The community needs money when it needs money, because we don't have any money, and we have the, and let's just be real, we bear the biggest burden. The one that has the least bears the biggest burden in terms of making the things happen in the community. But the thing, of course, that the community does have, a part of what Maylene was saying, that resiliency and whatnot, because we know how to ideally fix our problems, and we know how to make sustain anything that we choose to sustain. By hook or crook, we can make it happen if we choose to make it happen. And then what it's all about, again, occupying that space and doing it in synergy. It's just, and I've told people from the university and from the community, it just does not make sense that we would occupy this small space doing the same kinds of things and not be working in synergy. So it's walking in with the premise, as Maylene said, then you're not bad people. We each have our ideas about what happens and how things happen and that kind of thing, but the ideal thing is to come together and have the conversations, the hard conversations, not just that superfluous cute, when the dressing and we come in and we do it. No, let's get down to the meat and the potatoes of what it is that we're doing, but you have to be willing to do that and make your space in your place and know that we are here, we are a viable force, and we're happy to be here, and we're happy and welcome you to be a part, and we want to be a part. Okay. What we will be determined by what we're willing to do. The initial chair of GICRAT, this was his saying. And that's true. What we're willing to do. And that's what we try to live by. And we're steadily morphing. Because initially when we had come together, it was a group of community members wanting to try to continue an exercise and nutrition program. And what it, just getting that back, it had an aquatics component, the stay-at-home video. We just come together. We had a person come in and do aerobics, all that kind of stuff. So it was absolutely a wonderful program. Got together on Saturdays, cooked, created a cookbook, revising regular down-home Southern meals, making them healthier, that kind of thing. So we had all that. Well, how do we keep that going? And so we decided we'd come together and do that. But what we ended up morphing into was getting with an organization in Houston and learning how to really do CBPR, community-based participatory research. And of course, we're working with the community engaged. So all synonymous. And finding out what we needed to know and what we didn't know in order to do it and to go, say, to the university, when you call me in to say that we need to recruit some senior African Americans in a study, an aspirin study. Okay, we've already, so, well, okay. Ideally, and I'm a kind of shoot from the hip person. Never disrespectfully so, but I'm going, don't have time to mix words and get a ticket. Okay, well, okay. How long have you been doing this? Oh, we're about a year in. Having trouble getting people, are you? Well, okay, well, ideally, now this is the manner in which we normally work, is that at the time this would have been designed, that you would have called us. But such, now we find ourselves where we are, so we can see what we can do and work with this. Make the long of the story short, we got their 6-page consent form, and I'm like, who wants to read 6 pages? And then the reality of that situation, we are talking about seniors here, one, that there may be some literacy problems. I mean, not just not being able to read, the vision that goes along with that. And then we don't want to read 6 pages of anything. And then synthesize it and understand exactly what you're saying. So we worked through some things, and basically the long and the short, this is our recommendation in order for us to allow you to even talk to some of the communities, people, and organizations that we affiliate ourselves with. We need you to go back and get a one-pager that simply states what needs to happen around this area, and we will have one of our persons go with you, not endorsing the study, but saying that you, making sure that you are saying you need to check with your doctor, blah, 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 such the other. So we put some conditions on that, and they had to go back. But at this point, well, if you could have done it on your own, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Plain and simple. So let's say never in an ugly manner, but you always have to push forth. And because we learn as we do things, and the experience states, next time you'll think about it and whatnot, because now you find yourself in need and this will go lacking. So that's just a small part of some of the things we do. And then how do we, part of what it is, we ask questions. We created a process. We have a form of when a researcher wants to work with us or bring some research, here's this document you fill out. Send us the RFA. Let's look at this and talk. It goes to intervention work group, and they bring it back to the body saying, yes, we recommend that we do this. No, we recommend that we don't, and whatever. But we generally will work with anybody coming. We look for an opportunity to be able to work with the institution, because again, it builds the rapport that needs to be there, and it pushes us in as a community to delve further into that research. Always the direct approach. Hey, why beat around the bush? Cut to the chase. Ideally scripted, and a part of our mock, you will see the list of questions, the exhaustive list of questions that we give. And this, before we do any of this, you need to answer all of this. Because if you're about what you say you're about, you will have the answers. And for the ones that you don't have answers, we can work on that kind of thing. Always request a written response to become a part of your record so that you have it. Because again, you've got to have something. We're wonderful handshake and we're on the honor system. But when it gets down to the, when it gets down to business, you have to catch yourself. you need a document. And then just make a decision. Be willing to step out there and do hard. Okay, thank you.
So, are we clear on the instructions? Do you need some? Let's give them one more time, okay? So, Nancy, you want to?
Sure. I mean, Alice is passing out the mock case and the review questions, and what we were thinking it would be helpful is for people to read this mock case that was adapted from an actual case, and to use the questions that GCRAC has created to sort of review and think about, if you were reviewing this project, what would be some of the questions and concerns you might have for the research team? And, you know, using the questions, maybe thinking about, well, yeah, this is important. Does this also get asked maybe by an institution-based IRB? And, you know, have those kinds of conversations within your small group. Are there any questions? Because we can come around and help answer individual questions.
Thank you. and it's a very rare genetic issue. And we had quite a bit of discussion about
stand up and talk.
We were talking about how it was special community, and because this is a family study right now, how they would store samples and the youth, future use. And we wanted to find out more information about the family gatherings as to understand more about if that was actually an appropriate setting for gatherings. And concerns about coercion with some family members not wanting to be involved or feeling pressured by other family members. And we all know how this could go down. For the second, in terms of risk about the disease, members of the family, large community, how that would be handled. And key questions. We were talking about the consent in terms of my colleague here talks about if you do more genetic work.
Oh, just making sure, I just really wanted to see the consent form after we did this case study because I think that a lot of people store their DNA in repositories, and a lot of times, people don't know what genes are, people don't know what cells are, so I just wanted to see the form to make sure it's culturally and ethically appropriate.
And with that, we were thinking about the idea of, we're consenting individuals, but we're actually working with a group of families, so the idea of having consent is a family.
We spent a lot of time sorry about the problems with the proposal. That was before we even got to the second question. So we just wanted to know, we agreed that it was a lack of cultural sensitivity that they had in the family gathering. What we was concerned if the family was at the table or not prior to the proposal, or they informed prior. The risk to the family after they participate was what type of protection was the family given in terms of the results for the family from being protected from the community or throughout the community. What effects it had. I was curious to know, was he white or some parents in the past? What is his connection? In his relationship, even when he has a connection to family, what role does he really play?
Okay, is he in the community? Is he in the community?
Is he communicating in a culturally competent way? Do they really understand what's going on? Do they understand the culture? Are they speaking with lingo or language that they're not quite familiar with?
Maybe a conflict of interest with his medical system since he has some kind of ties to his family. I'm not sure what it looks like. Maybe he just put there because he has some roles and he's going to comply. Confidentiality. I'm concerned about that. Because they're really informed about the confidentiality, the DNA storage process, or things like you mentioned. How protected are the information?
What do you know with the data after?
With the data stored. Who owns the data? Does the family think it was necessary to study? Who decided to study? Who decided to target a particular family? Why this particular family is be concerned? And does the study validate based on the results of this one family? Intervention. Are they looking to prevent, other genetic defects going on in our world?
having success. And it was compensation for the family. Would the family be compensated for this study? Also, it seems like a relatively small sample size. So, you know, how much study, what is it really going to produce? And as a result of the study, if there is a genetic disease ever, what treatment, medical treatment will be provided? Will the insurance cover it if this new genetic disease is discovered? And are there any participants that said they wanted to do the children to team up? And try to see, again, if some members want to participate and others don't. If we're at a family event, so there's no sheet and curtain, anything going on, so again, family dynamic.
First of all, you all get up and sit at this table. You know more about this stuff than we did 14 years ago when it came up for us. You guys are amazing. You're just so far ahead of the game. This study did come to us, but it was not as nice as this one. It had, and I'll tell the story from the point of view of a Native Hawaiian who knows nothing about genetics, okay? A researcher from an unnamed institution in Hawaii got a hold of an autopsy report. And the autopsy report identified the person who died as having a very rare disease that was untreatable. There's no cure for it. But it lived within number 9, notch 19 of the genetic code, which has a lot to do with migraines. And, you know, there are a lot of people out in this world make billions of dollars on migraine medicine, right? So this researcher who was a geneticist and his nurse, who was working on her PhD, said to themselves, wow, I'm making this up. Wow, this is our road to the Holy Grail, right? Yeah, here we are, Nobel Peace Prize, coming our way. So they got the information and identified the family, which happened to live on the island which I live, which is a large Native Hawaiian family, about 300 people. And at that time, I was directing the Native Hawaiian healthcare system on the island. And they came to this family, they identified that family, and the doctor who treated the woman, and this is a disease kind of like Lou Gehrig's, you know, it starts very early and it rapidly degrades the body. You start having aura and headaches, and you start, and that rapidly increases to strokes, and you start losing the ability to speak, to walk. And by the time you're in your late 30s, you're in bed. You can't move. And we saw, you know, the family over, they could identify, they could take it back to like 160 years. When it started appearing about 160 years ago, and Hawaiians looked at something that happens in your family like this as a form of a, what we could, I don't know how to translate it, but it's kind of like a curse. And so we have a way of dealing with it culturally. And so there are two brothers who are the only ones left in that family that were not affected yet. And they got together and they said, listen, we're going to have to ho'oponopono, which means it's our way of putting things straight, of cutting off whatever that curse is so we can move forward with our families. So they did that. One of the brothers changed, and we believe in names. What you say is what is. So one of the brothers changed his name altogether. And the other brother said, well, I'm not going to be that drastic. I'll put something in front of the name and a prefix and a suffix. It'll be a different name, but we keep the core. So they went on their merry way. The brother who cut off the name totally, his line of the family never got the disease. The brother who held on to the core but added the prefix and the suffix continued the line of the disease. So that's our way of handling this. So anyway, the researchers come in, the doctor puts them in touch with the family, they go to the family reunion and they say, hey, listen up, you guys. We know what you have. And it's not a curse. Aren't you lucky? It's not a curse. It's a genetic condition. However, we have no treatment for it. There's no cure for it. But now you know, you're not cursed anymore. And people went, what? You know, what do you mean? They took away, these researchers took away the hope that these people had, and they replaced it with nothing. Okay? Absolutely nothing. And, you know, Hawaiians are, you know, part of folk like you. You know, we love to eat, we love to dance, we love to sing, we're open, and you come in, we welcome you, we feed you, we take care of you. So they came in at the family reunion, of course you're going to get fed, and, you know, welcome and all this sort of stuff. He said, hey, listen, we're going to advance science. Don't you want to advance science? And maybe someday, we don't have now, maybe someday there'll be a cure. So, okay. The people said, okay, cool, you know, maybe someday, maybe we'll pay a part. So they took, without consent, hair, skin, blood. Then they disappeared. Nobody knew who they were, what happened to the samples. And it was like 2 or 3 years down the line, and we were having a seminar on ethics in our system. And I brought in someone from IHS who was a director of research, and he did a 2-day seminar. And all my staff wanted to go to it, including my valuable assistant secretary. She sat through all this, and at the end of the seminar, she raised her hand. Nobody had questions, either doctors, nurses, big-time people, you know. She raised her hand. She's sitting back. She says, by ethics, do you mean if somebody comes and takes your blood and your hair and your skin, they gotta have informed consent? Yeah, you do. And not only that, in the form of consent, you must understand what it's all about, you know. And if it's a genetic study, you got to explain what that is. If it's something like Lou Gehrig's disease, it's something entirely different, you know. And this particular disease is autosomal dominant, which means it makes no distinction as to male or female. You don't know if you've got the gene, you've got the disease, okay. So by taking the genetic matter of the human tissue of these people, the scientists could tell you who's and what's up. So we were all shocked. This is 2 or 3 years down the line. So we made some phone calls to this institution that very day. Have you heard about this thing, this genetic study? Have you heard about this doctor? And so the person who was in charge of the IRB said, oh, yeah, he's going to be presenting at this conference on this particular disease. And we said, when's this conference going to be? Oh, well, it's going to be in about a week, you know. And we said, you better stop that right now because let me tell you what happened. So we told them the whole story about what happened. And ta-da, this geneticist, which is actually an MD with a specialty, neuro brain surgeon or whatever, and his nurse were stopped. The doctor lost his job. He was vanquished. He couldn't live there anymore in that institution. He left the islands. The nurse never got her PhD, you know, but that's how serious it is. And it took this particular person, my secretary, who is kind of like the bottom line, you know, my secretary is the person who makes sure that, you know, I've got clothes on when I get up in the morning, you know. That's how honored that I am. But she was unique. She came from this family of Hawaiian people who knew nothing. So innocent, you know, we know nothing. We're taken advantage of. And so we had to learn. All the stuff you guys are saying, you guys already know. We knew nothing about genetics. We knew nothing about protection. Nothing at all. Well, let me tell you about that. Yes, they did. They approved of this genetic study. And then after the injury, you know how you have to go back every year to get renewal? They approved it again. Yeah, so... Well, here we are. The University of Hawaii were contrived. The Dean of Medicine came over and apologized to the family, blah, 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 blah. And the hospital, which was involved with it, gave the family, I don't know, $20,000 to help deal with some of the leftover depression, anxiety, and yeah, I know. You know, it was amazing. The family, because they're Hawaiian, did not want to get into litigation. They did not want that in their lives. They wanted to take care of the people who were left on the ground who were suffering. And so our healthcare system took care of them. We had a Hawaiian doctor who said, we can't cure this disease. Now it's out, but we will take care of all the other things that are happening to you that make you stronger and more resilient to stuff like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, whatever it is. You're going to get from now on, every month we had the Hawaiian diet. You come in, it's a 3-day every weekend, as long as you like, for free. We'll do that. We'll monitor your health. We'll give you free exercise, massage therapy. We will take care of you. And that's how we dealt with it as a Native Hawaiian healthcare system. We can't change what happened. There's no way we can change. And we started our own IRB after that. Said, no more. You want to come to our community? You come see us, guys. Yeah? And the difference in our IRB is we are a community-based IRB. The community has the power that sits on that board. And if a community person says, hey, wait a minute, I don't understand, everything stops. Or if a community member says, no, I don't agree, the thing doesn't go through. In a regular IRB, it's majority wins. Doesn't matter if you understand or not. Doesn't matter if you disagree. Nothing matters. What matters is majority wins. But not in our IRB. The majority doesn't win. Who wins is everybody. There's got to be understanding and consensus to anything that passes. It has to be culturally relevant and sensitive. And we ask you, have you seen the community? Do you have an advisory board? Are you working with them? Have they invited you in? Does this scientific construct or question come from the community? Does it have meaning to them? How are they protected? You know, are you going to come back and report to the community, as Zachman said? Are they co-investigators? Do you have the right of editing your publication? Do they present at conferences? You're going to present. We want them up there, too. So these are the kinds of things that, what is it, power to the people? Soul is power to the people. But you have that power because it's about you. People are not studying ghosts or whatever maybe they are, but they're studying you. It's you. It's your community. It's you, your families, your children. It's what's happening to you. You have the power. It's about you. So why not join and be a partner in that? Seek parity. Seek what is actually yours. You need to be at the table. You need to help design this. You need to help plan it. You need to help execute it. And it makes things so much better. So much better for science, for you, for your families. We can all move together. We don't have to be, you know, at cross purposes. We can move together, move faster, be brilliant in our work, yeah? Not just a little thing kind of, you know, in the corner. No, make it shine. Yeah. The little light that shines for the people in the valley so they can see, that's what it's all about. Do you want to have questions?
There are a couple of questions.
You're absolutely correct. However, there was not, you know how there's a committee that has to report to the feds and the IRB has to report to the feds within 48 hours any harm done? That was never done. Okay, and so here we are, we're stupid. We don't know anything. We didn't know the source of it, of the money. They also ran out of money. The samples, the human samples were lost. They don't know where it is. So that's how egregious this whole thing was.
So what we want to do now is move into some Q&A, not just specific to this particular question, but I knew that when you had an opportunity to be exposed to forces of nature, Mother Nature and other forces of nature, that this would really spark a lot of conversation. And I think that one of the things that Maylene points out, or to me that's clear, is that this is about all of us. and it's about all our communities. So while the case study was really kind of focused on the work that was being done in Hawaii, John is here and others on the team, and so maybe all of us want to come up, and if you we could then now kind of engage in some Q&A time. And I know you've been kind of like putting your hand up, like up and down, like pick me. So I'm going to pick you first, and let's move forward with, come on down. Go ahead.
I'll stand up.
Please.
I don't understand the question. How can you stop it before something egregious happens?
So the community IRB that you created sounds really amazing and has a lot more power than most community IRBs that I'm familiar with. So how do you make a community IRB that is that powerful and it can stop something somebody doesn't understand or somebody doesn't agree without having this egregious act beforehand?
How can you stop it? Well, you know, with the IRB, I don't know if you're familiar with IRBs and the power that they have. If an IRB says no, you're denied approval, then you cannot have that protocol at all. It stops everything dead. Well, we are a community IRB, which means we're also federally recognized. We have our FWA, we're an IRB with the FWA. So we have the federal power support behind us to say to anyone that comes to us for a review whether or not they can proceed or whether or not they have to change or whether or not they cannot do it. So that's the power of an IRB. And once an IRB vetoes or denies you the power to have a protocol, you gotta stop everything. And if you don't stop everything, you then are sanctioned by whoever gave you the money. And IRBs get their power from the feds. Any federal research project must go through an IRB. You must have that and take it back to NIA, CDC, wherever you got to run from. And if you are denied the ability to do your research and you proceed anyway, I would hate to think what would happen to you from the feds. That would close your shop.
You know, there's also one thing, Mei Ling, that I really liked on your application form is that you specify that if there are multiple IRBs involved, Papa'ololokahi's IRB decision takes precedence. It's like right there. And
Because you know, people go out and they get several. Sometimes when you get money from NIA, you have to get approval from your university, first of all. Then maybe a hospital or clinic you're working with. Then whoever else. If you're IHS, you got to get approval from your tribe. You know, from the district people, and then from national IRB that's multiple clinics. Same thing with us. When we look at a study, a lot of times, they have to get it from the hospital or from the university. They each have their own IRB. But we stated in ours that if we say something or no, we take precedence. Yeah.
Thank you. Another question? Yes.
It's a good one. It's a very good one. I see the director almost every week. We have lunch together. We have formed a study group. I sit on one of their boards. They have a committee review board. We learned early in the game it's better to partner and change than it is to fight. Because we're after the same thing, which is new knowledge and advancing the health of everybody. You know, it's not about breaking down anything; it's about building up.
And
alluded to when I was talking out of the Partners in Research, Bridging the Gap. You share the same space. Why are you fighting? Let's learn how we both work and then figure out how we work together. And it's about leaving them better than you found them. It's a bi-directional. They are growing you and you are growing them. So you have to. That's the only way it works. And I mean, it is with so much out there, and especially in my community, in the African American community, with the disparities, we have the worst case of all of it. Okay? So good sense would say you seek out the help that you need to do it. And again, that's, you know, how I'm going to come over here and ask you for this cup of water and come to you with an attitude fighting you every step of the way. Now, I'm not, you don't have to diminish in any way. But you go in, work with the mindset that we are going to come together to do this, and this is going to be mutually beneficial. Mutually beneficial. And you work at it. Is it always easy? No. But you invest the time. You invest all of what it is and keep your eye on the prize. Because it's really not about you. It's about the people that you say you represent and that are part of your family members, your friends, the people you go to church with, the people you hang with, and do all of what it is you do, and hopefully making that, all of our situations, better. And how can you help me make this better? And then I can bring something to you that's going to further you because you're looking for 10-year publications and all that other kind of good stuff. So, hey, we can work this thing out.
So with that, that's going to be our last question, I believe. And so would you please give our speakers a round of applause? So they're coming, they will be here afterwards. I will say that typically there's another session after this one. And so we'll have to move out of this room, space perhaps. But please stay around. I wanted to, and Alice is going to close us out, but I just want to remind you and just announce for you, for those of you who were not with us last night, that Community Campus Partnerships for Health is excited to announce that our 2016 International Conference will be held here in New Orleans, May 11th through 14th, and I'm going to share these with you and hope that you will join us and visit our website as well. And with that, Alice will close us out, I believe.
Thank you. So I think we just wanted to close out the session with our last 5 minutes and just talking a little bit around, and John touched on this already, a little bit of the benefits and challenges and then recommendations and then what are next steps. And I just wanted to point out this one piece, what we kind of found across all these sites is this idea of regulatory plus, which I think Nancy is the one who coined. So Mei Ling talked about how these community IRBs, they follow the same rules and regulations as any other IRB that's housed in an institution, but beyond that, they kind of add this layer of these community and cultural level considerations. So it's just kind of this regulatory plus. And with that additional layer of review, what ended up happening is that they really end up enhancing the design and, in particular, the impact of the research, really suggesting ways that the research can actually have a genuine impact for the communities, leave a legacy, et cetera. And it's really just a role that is just not being fulfilled by the institution IRBs. They're just not at this community level considerations. I think the biggest challenges for these communities review processes is the lack of funding. So whereas institution-based IRBs are typically funded through the indirects that the university receives, not all community-based organizations have an indirect rate, so they don't have this ability to fund. And as a result of that, the CRPs can end up with inadequate infrastructure, which can result in not enough staffing, and as a result of that, they aren't able to review as many proposals as they would like to if they had more resources. And I think along with that is just this lack of recognition that, you know, Mei Ling was pointing, particularly those ones that are IRBs, not all of them are, but if they are actually a fairly recognized IRB, I don't think that's recognized that's the same. It's the identical as if it was housed in an institution. So it's a lack of that recognition that they're reviewing the exact, they have to follow the exact identical guidelines as any university, there's this lack of respect. So, and then in terms of recommendations, I think one of the questions you were asking about is how can these community review processes be more powerful? It's a way that they can really impact before this horrible research happens. And what really seemed to occur across these CRPs is that they kind of mentored with each other. Each of them helped and talked to another review process when they developed what were the things that you considered when you built your review. So I think this is the way that they become a very powerful community review process, is creating this network. And where there's the Primer Conference, which is the APHA of the human subjects world, in no way does it ever touch on any of these community review processes. They need a professional network and professional development for the reviewers. So not city, which again doesn't cover anything around like this additional layer of considerations that the community review process is doing, but something that really counts into the community and cultural considerations. And I think on the institutional IRBs, our strongest recommendation for them is to increase the number of community reviewers, and we mean genuine community reviewers, those who actually are connected or actually are familiar with the communities involved in the research. And I think the funders could fill this role of being able to support the community review process, given that lack of the indirects to be able to support them. And then I'm going to skip through this, and we did that already. One of the things that we wanted to do was really kind of follow through on the policy piece of it. And so we were able to do that with funding from the Greenwald Foundation. And these are the aims of our study. We're articulating a set of ethical principles that actually will consider community-engaged research, so actually drafting revisions for the Belmont Report and the regulations so that it will include these community-engaged research ethical considerations, and then coming up with these scenarios for a system of research review that then effectively assesses the community-engaged research ethics. So as part of this process, it's a one-year study. We're about halfway through. We will be creating drafts of these revised principles and looking for feedback. So if you would be interested in sharing some feedback, we have a sign-up sheet here on the front that we can you can add your email, and then we can send that to you. And all of the information that we touched on is in depth in our full case study report, which you can find on our website. Mei Ling will actually be presenting at the Primer Conference December 6th for anyone who happens to be going to that conference as well. And also I was going to say, if you didn't get a handout, I think we ran out of a few of them, feel free to add your name to the list, or grab a handout in the back that has information on the Greenwald study, and it has our email, so that's another way. So either way, whatever is easiest for you, add your email or just email us if you wanted any of the handouts. So just acknowledgments to our wonderful study partners who were able to make it, and for those that were unable to come, and just thank you for all your thoughtful consideration.